It's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall, and now we head to Calvert Street in Baltimore to catch the boat to the magical land of Illyria. Last week, Center Stage opened a rollicking and hilarious production of Shakespeare's iconic comedy, Twelfth Night. It's about mistaken identity, love at first sight, honor, passion, and pranks. Gavin Witt is the Associate Artistic Director and Director of Dramaturgy at Center Stage. He directs this show, his first full production as director at Center Stage. Ryan McCurdy plays the role of Valentine and several other characters. He's also the music supervisor, and he plays a half a dozen musical instruments throughout the course of the proceedings. Gavin Witt and Ryan McCurdy join me in the studio. Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
So I saw opening night last week, and I thought this was just a terrific show. So congratulations to you both and to all of your colleagues on this project. So, Gavin, you have done work at Center Stage, obviously, for several years now as the dramaturg, but you've also been an actor. You've also directed. I wonder, when you take this piece, a very famous piece that many other people have taken a pretty close look at, for the first time, as you're directing it, are you looking at it with different eyes as a director than you would as a dramaturg?
Essentially, Tom, I am, yes. Although, as I concede to everyone, a lot of my approach did begin very dramaturgically in that I was really attracted by the idea of representing or digging into the what I call the Illyrian-ness of it. That part of my dramaturgy I kept with me. I wanted to really think about how that place, in whatever way we decided it meant, informed the play.
Yeah, and so what did you decide it meant? This is this sort of fantastical, magical, mythical place.
Exactly. Well, both mythical, but also a little bit rooted in a real. It's based in the stretch of the Balkan Peninsula along the Adriatic coast, sort of former Yugoslavia, above Greece. But also, as it would have been for Shakespeare's audiences, a kind of never-never land, a little bit of a mythical that place off the boundaries of the map.
So place for you in this particular play is very important. I mean, all of the shenanigans that take place of people, you know, mistaking mm-hmm. people for other people and falling in love at first sight, you know, the drop of a hat, it matters that it's happening in this crazy place.
It did to me in a way. I think both by virtue of this idea of the borderland or the crossroads, because I think the play has a kind of fluidity or this meeting point of lives and cultures and outlooks and identities, but also just that sense of the exotic, the permission that it gave us. And we tried to work with the music, with costumes. We really tried to root it in that place, but as you saw, in a way that was through a filter of the imaginary, in a way that I think was true to what Shakespeare and his audience were encountering. And so our filter became the kind of Hollywood classic studio cinema.
Yeah, it's kind of film noir and the 30s yeah. movies yeah, and the way that funny
and that
comedies.
Era just so happens in that era when much was going on there, that area was similarly exotic and mysterious and intriguing. Mm-hmm. The made-up land of Ruritania was famous from The Prisoner of Zenda, or Balkanica in The Lady Vanishes.
Yeah, the Balkans, right.
The Balkans.
Yeah. So, Ryan McCurdy, you have both a music and an acting background. When you come to a production like this, you and the cast, what is the role of dramaturgy and the role of the director and the role of the folks who are helping you place yourselves in this place with all of these people? What kind of background is important to you to know as an actor doing Shakespeare?
Well, when we're lucky, we get someone like Gavin who actually has prepared a structure for us. So I've also done Shakespeare that has been sort of plunked or put down into a place without any explanation why, other than they thought it might look cool. And so for a group of actors to come in and to have a world built around what the concept is takes it from being simply sort of a visual homage to a place and helps you start to live in that place. So I think for myself, every time I do Shakespeare, if it's going to be done in a classical sense, we need dramaturgically to know what the relationships would have meant in the time period and how we're evolving that for our production, which I've done several times in New York. But coming into this experience and having and being able to see the walls of photography and know what we were doing is deeply deeply useful for us as actors.
Mm-hmm. So Gavin, it seems to me this was a kind of a hybrid in a way, because it wasn't like you plunked it in 1930, but because there were so many elements of Renaissance Elizabethan culture. In particular, I think of the text of the music. I mean, there were some songs sung where the text was Renaissance and the music was much more contemporary. And I love that melding of the two things. But you rooted in this place. You dress people in this sort of filmy way from the 30s, but they still got to speak the Shakespearean language. Is there a disconnect? I mean, this argument about whether Shakespeare should be placed in contemporary setting or not has been going on forever. How do you see that challenge? How do you frame that challenge?
Well, it's great, and I think to some extent that hybriding you're talking about, or the synthesis, I like to think of it maybe more, was going on musically very, very much in this crossroads of cultures. But I guess not to be glib, but I take that argument as settled. I think since the 1880s, 1890s, Harley Granville Barker, we began to accept that we could do Shakespeare not exclusively in pumpkin pants and ruffs, which for me is actually incredibly authentic, because his audiences didn't come and see 500-year-old antiquity. They came and saw the world they knew.
Well, as a guy who looks particularly bad in pumpkin pants and any other kind of pants for that matter, I'm delighted to hear that there don't have to be in every Shakespeare play. Ryan McCurdy, I was very impressed with the rhythm of the text as spoken by the actors. The cadence, the rhythm, the tempo of it seemed perfectly timed to me. Is that something that you worked on a lot? I call it rhythm. I mean, as a fellow musician, maybe that's not even the theatrical term, but there was a countenance to the language that just, it flowed musically to my ears. Is that something that you were working on consciously?
I think so. Well, there's a lot of, outside of the public rehearsals, there's a lot of one-on-one discussion about who are these people to each other. And it's generally called musicality when a play with music takes on that sort of rhythm. And we were lucky enough, we have a score by composer Palmer Heffernan. And the more that we started to hear that, the more that everyone's cadences took on what you hear musically. And there's this great thing called the interior-exterior meetup, where the interior dialogue does start to feel like the exterior music that's being played. And so I think that's a completely conscious thing, but it's something that has to happen only if the right people are involved. It's not something that sort of naturally evolves. So I think this is the situation of the right group of people being able to perform in that sort of way. But I know exactly what you're talking about. And as a musician, sometimes first I hear it, and I don't know if all the actors are conscious of it, but I'm certainly glad that it's happening.
Two, I think in that you have 11 actors coming together who likely have never worked together and likely never met. They come into a room, they have to learn to speak a common language. Some of that common language was informed by the musical universe in which they were able to live as we started to hear Palmer's compositions. The other piece of that, though, is in the Shakespeare. It's the verse and the meter, and they would go off and explore that with a voice and text person. And then the shifts from verse to prose, and can you serve that, and can you figure out what the emotional truth of that is, of why does this character need to go into verse here, or why do these scenes shift into prose? And so it shouldn't be necessarily an explicitly conscious experience, but that you picked it up in a play that begins with the first line talking about music, I think is appropriate.
Right. If music be the food of love, play on, right? From the first line. There are all sorts of iconic lines in this show. Perhaps the most iconic, some are born great, some achieve greatness, and some have greatness thrust upon them. And that actually appears three or four times. I'm not a theater historian or a dramaturg, so I don't know. Is that in the script that it appears that many times? Did you alter the script at all? Did you alter the text? Fess up now if you did.
No, I will absolutely fess up. No, we did that. That does appear that many times. Mm-hmm. It is recurring right up to the very end with Feste's vindicated triumph over Malvolio.
So Shakespeare knew he had a hit there.
Shakespeare knew he had a hit with that line. Yeah. He knew that was going to go good. He's, you don't want to too much outthink Shakespeare and his brilliant dramaturgy. But more what I did was remove. The play would run probably well over 3.5 hours if we did the whole thing. There's mm-hmm. an enormous amount, and we are just under two, or just at 2 hours right now. So there's a lot we took out. I would also confess that I adjusted a little bit of scene order to the Sebastian Antonio story. Felt to me, at least in this production, I wanted it to be more central, mm-hmm. Or to be sort of at least in sort of equal accompaniment to the other stories, and that mm-hmm. this the story of these twins and the way that it falls, it can become an afterthought. So while they're the same they were, we just encounter them a little sooner in each half of the play mm-hmm. than otherwise.
And that's pretty typical. I mean, directors take those kinds of liberties. Stuff around.
Shakespeare emailed me the mm-hmm. other day mm-hmm. to give me explicit approval all the changes. It was very convenient. It's public. You know, people do all kinds of things with it. It didn't take enormous liberties, but also, you know, reducing from a play that probably calls for a cast of 16 or 20 or something, we had to condense. So speeches are ascribed to other characters, but they get spoken. Mm-hmm. And we found a way to make sense of them, I think, from those characters. And
so, Ryan, how do you think, I mean, you're in previews, you know, a couple of weeks ago, you've been rehearsing it for, you know, a month or so. You've been open now for, you know, less than a week. How do you think this show is going to change? How do you think it's going to evolve from performance to performance between now and the 6th of April when you close?
I think I'm already seeing the cast start to really settle into the relationships. And I think this is a play that, because it's a melting pot and it's a meeting point, it's what two people say to each other when they look at each other. The visual is lovely of the show and the music is great, but it has to end up being what two people say to each other. And I'm seeing each of the individual relationships start to build. And Shakespeare built so many subplots into this show that it's very sitcom-y at times, that you're following threads of different things. I'm watching people learn how to tell each individual story from beginning to end, which is, you know, rewarding for me sort of as a supernumerary to watch. And in addition, I think the show is going to settle just from a completely technical standpoint. There are so many instruments with so many moving parts. There's so much going on that we're starting to find the sort of precision art of doing that to make sure that by the time we're into this run, that everyone's getting everything that we prepared for them.
Yeah, well, it was a beautiful thing to be in the audience listening to Elizabethan text by, you know, the granddaddy of all text writers, and having people react to it the way they would react to a rom-com movie or a sitcom. I mean, it was a very connected audience the night that I was there, and I'm sure that's continued.
We have found that, and I think we have talked about it amongst ourselves, that the greatest pleasure we get are not the sight gags, are not even the gag lines, and there are some very funny jokes, but are the story laughs, where people are going on the journey and seeing the payoff to these relationships and to the investment they've made in the love stories or the battles going on between characters, whatever. And those, as any rom-com or anything else would have done, they pay off beautifully. Those are great.
Gavin Witt and Ryan McCurdy from Baltimore's Center Stage. Shakespeare's 12th Night is at Center Stage until April 6th. The theater has announced most of the plays that they'll be presenting next season as well. You can find links to information about 12th Night and next year's offerings on our website, wipr.org/Marilyn Morning. And next Monday here on Marilyn Morning, theater critic J. Wynn Russick will give us her review of 12th Night. Well, Gavin Witt, Ryan McCurdy, break a leg for the rest of the run, and thanks so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having us, Tom.
Tomorrow, Sheila continues the checkup, our weekly look at the impact of the Affordable Care Act, and she'll have a conversation with an original Rosie the Riveter. I hope you can join us tomorrow morning on Marilyn Morning. Until then, I'm Tom Hall. Happy St. Patrick's Day, everybody. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.